Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome back to Overnight America. Wow, that story about the woman who caught the dealership employee taking her car out for a joyride. Apparently that happens. We get a text message in, and I won't say the person's name, just in case they don't want me to. It says, some years ago, my brother had a car he had taken to a dealership for some work and was kept over the weekend. One of the co-workers then told him Monday that he saw his car over the weekend at a drag strip. My brother confronted the dealership. They did nothing, so our father got involved and called the president of General Motors and actually spoke to him within 15 minutes and said that he was going to make the owner of the dealership make it right and treat my brother above and beyond, or he's going to send trucks to lift all of his inventory and pull their franchise. Now, that's how you get it done. Bravo, GM. That's awesome to hear. James calling in. What's going on, James?
Yeah, I was just calling in because we dropped a vehicle off for an inspection, and then all of a sudden I get a phone call back from them saying that the transmission is done on the vehicle, had no transmission problem whatsoever.
Oh, no.
So always a little bit hesitant after that.
Was it a actual dealership, or was it a mechanic, or was it independent, or what was it?
I guess that it wasn't a dealership. I guess that you would call it an independent franchise, but a well-known franchise. And, you know,
wow.
Don't want to throw them underneath the bus, but, you know.
No issue with the trans? Yeah.
No, none at all. And you drop it off, and then all of a sudden you get a phone call, and, you know, not the phone call that you expect. You think that your car will be ready, and then you get something like that.
How old was the car that you took in?
It was about 9 years old. So.
Oh, wow. Let me tell you, the dealerships that I love are, well, actually, there was a mechanic I used to go to when I lived in Indiana. They were awesome. So, so good. Let me tell you a couple things that they would do to me. I would bring the car in, and this is what they would say to me. They'd say, well, you probably have, I don't know, a half a year to a year left on this. You could fix it now, or it doesn't cost anything extra to wait for it to break. So you could wait if you want, or you can get it fixed now. They would say things like that to you, which to me, I'm like, you're giving it to me straight. That's what I want. I want you to give it to me straight. I don't want you to try to force me to get something. And if they try to force your hand and whatever happened with that transmission, who knows? It's quite suspicious if you never had an issue before then.
Exactly.
What do you think they were doing?
Call in.
You think they were hot-dogging with it? You think they were like doing, you know, messing around with it and messed it up?
I don't think hot-dogging. I think that they were just looking for an extra repair, and who knows what, you know, what went on in the shop and what made, you know, problem occur. So
what did you
anyways,
do? Did you end up getting it repaired there, or did you go somewhere else?
No, I took it to my, sort of like you said, you trust somebody that's close by, and then all of a sudden after you go through all that, you go back to your regular mechanic, and you get everything resolved, and everything was, you know, good to go after that. But unfortunately, you just get tied up with family and things going on, and unfortunately, just make a bad decision.
Yeah, I get it. All right, thanks, James. Good to hear from you.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Man, that drives me crazy. I hate hearing stories like that. Got some trust issues, you know? And rightfully so, you got some trust issues. Here's a couple of tech stories. You know what happened yesterday, Sunday? Well, I guess technically 2 days ago now that it's 1:09 in St. Louis, Missouri. But it marked the 30th anniversary of the Game Boy. Oh, I love the Game Boy. I remember when my mom purchased it, it was because she wanted to play Tetris and she allowed us kids to play it. So it wasn't even something she was buying for us. It was I want to play this puzzle game that was extremely popular. And then, you know, when I'm not playing it, go ahead and have some fun with it. I used to play all kinds of games on it. The original Game Boy was perfect for those car trips. We used to take trips to New Jersey to visit family from Michigan. There was one time we traveled from Michigan down here to St. Louis. My Dad was doing a family reunion thing down here, and it was cool. Everything was awesome. Play your little Game Boy. You can finish games up. And then they came out with other types of Game Boys and, you know, color Game Boys, and then they had advanced Game Boys and Super DSs and whatever. I never went past the original one. Never got into it. But I'll tell you, I love the, I just thought it was the greatest system ever. You ever been to one of those museums or tech displays that would show these melted Game Boys that were involved in, like, areas of war, and there would be extreme heat and the plastic would melt, but the system would still work? Those old Nintendos work great because the cartridge bases were just built so well. You know, my original Nintendo, I still have it. It works. Well, I was at my parents' house, but the I still have my Super Nintendo that works. I still have my Nintendo 64 that works. It's perfect. Man, those things just, they don't make them like that anymore. These longevity of these systems. You get any of these new ones, I don't know how many times I've seen someone get an Xbox and they get that error thing and it stops working, or a PlayStation. They got to go purchase a new one. It's not made to last for a decade because they anticipate you buying the next system. It's kind of like your cell phones, right? They don't anticipate you using your cell phone for 10 years. So the battery dies after three, and then it slows down to the point where they just want you to go buy another $1,000 phone because they know you'll do it. That's like the Apple mindset. You know, they have, here's a little tip too when it comes to these things. A lot of these electronics have design flaws, and they try to play it off as if it was user error that these things fail. But they're design flaws within the product itself, and they probably could be repaired, but they discourage it heavily because they don't want you going out and getting something repaired as opposed to you upgrading to buy the new product. So frustrating, some of these business models you see with tech companies like Apple, for example. They put a good product out, but man, it's just so underhanded the way that they handle it. Let me mention this too real quick, because I said I would. So the mental health apps that you find on your mobile phones, and I don't know if anyone uses them. I don't personally, but there was an article on The Verge that was something that I've warned a lot of people about when it comes to your privacies and your protections and making sure that you go above and beyond to not voluntarily give out private information. If you have a mobile phone and you download an app and you are plugging it full of sensitive information, you better know who you're working with, because free apps that are marked on these phones that are should help people, like, for example, quit smoking or quit drugs or with depression or with certain thoughts, things like that, they build themselves as, we're going to help you. But you know what they're doing? They're selling your data without your knowledge. In some cases, in the worst case scenarios, they even explicitly say, we do not sell and we do not take your data. And then when they actually hooked these up to the machines, they were tracking what was going on behind the scenes on these apps, what data was being sent out, what was being tracked in. They found out that, yes, they are doing these things. So they went through some of the biggest apps in the App Store for your Android or iPhone, and they looked through all of them, like the top 35 or something like that. And they discovered that 92% of the 36 apps shared data with at least one third party, mostly Facebook or Google-run services for marketing, advertising, and data analytics. About half of those apps didn't disclose that they were sharing your info. And of those 36, three of them specifically said they would never sell your data. This is so dangerous. And I'm going to read this one line because I've been saying this for as long as I've been on the show here on KMOX. We live in an age where, with enough breadcrumbs, it's possible to re-identify people. Now, they call these invisible risks. That's Stephen Chan, a physician at the Veterans Affairs Palo Alto Healthcare System. So what happens? And you think, oh, you know, no big deal. They're going to pop up an app. They're going to do this, or they're going to, you know, advertise to me in a certain way. But, you know, it's great because I don't have to pay for the app or whatever it is. No, you shouldn't be so nonchalant about these things. Think about what happens when you could be identified for mental health issues. All right? Now, this is not a tinfoil hat problem. This is what they do. Now, if they can figure out who you are, and we'll just use the term breadcrumbs like they did in this quote from The Verge. Let's say they can put the pieces together. Why? Because they've been trying to put the pieces together for everything you do online. you know, if you're logged in a certain way, if you send certain names a certain way, if you have your GPS trackers on and they know where you're at, they can geolocate you, they can do this, they can do that, whatever it is that you've given permissions for these apps voluntarily to do. Now, what happens if they sell this third information? And to me, the biggest risk is healthcare providers. What if you're denied services in the future because they say, well, actually, this is pre-existing because I remember one time you loaded it up on an app and you said that you had these thoughts. So we're going to count this as a pre-existing condition. So you're no longer eligible for insurance for this tragedy that just happened to you. It's something that just spontaneously happened to you. Or imagine you're trying to get privately insured or whatever. You start to work for yourself. And then all of a sudden they say, oh, wait a minute. Well, ooh, this person talked about certain traits and that's pretty similar to MS. So we can't afford to insure you, so we're not going to allow you to be insured through our company. What if they deny you services based on this private information that they told you they weren't going to sell on you? And it goes beyond that. What about any of this information, how it could be used against you? What if, you know, police, for example, get a hold of this information? Do you want, or the government, let's just say the government, what if they use it as a way to surveil you? Do you want that sort of thing? No, you shouldn't. You should be very careful with who you trust with all of your private matters. And the fact that you downloaded a mental health application on your phone, they are preying on you. They are using you, and they are doing that. That is so irresponsible. That is predatory. You're falling for it. And you have to be so careful with everything you do, not just online, but on your phone, and things that you think are private or not. Everyone's out there. There's so many predatory services. And Google and Facebook and companies like that are buying this information, they're not innocent. They know what they're doing is wrong. They know that they shouldn't be getting private information from mental health applications as ways to try to market to you. That is so predatory. This is what technology has come to today. This is why you need protections when it comes to technology. It's just so disappointing. I hope you check out that on The Verge. And please, please, please never give out more information than you need to. In fact, probably better for you to give out no information at all, at all. It's Overnight America, KMOX. In a little bit, we're going to join Chris Tuff, the Millennial Whisperer. Yeah, what do we need to know about working with millennials? I am a tail-end millennial, so I'm basically at the very low end of it. It's funny the way you said it. There's like two different types of millennials. Instagram millennials and Oregon Trail millennials. The ones that grew up in the most exciting video game they had was Oregon Trail, right? That's me. Hey. But, you know, there's a wide range of it. And what does that mean for the workplace? Maybe you work with some millennials and notice things are a little bit different. We're going to talk to him about that coming up. You know, what are the worst, most stressful jobs in America? I hate these things because every time these lists come out, you know what happens? Oh, congratulations. Your job's always in the top 10. So this is what they say. Some careers have dangerous tasks, high level of stress, public scrutiny. They're all commonplace and they can take a toll on employee satisfaction. Doesn't necessarily matter who the boss is. But many of the worst jobs in America rank poorly because they are among the least when it comes to job security. And job security is a hard thing to do anymore. St. Louis is different than a lot of other places I live. There's a lot of union support in St. Louis. And because of things like that, you do have certain protections, even though it doesn't mean you're going to have a job for life. Like here at KMOX, this is a union job. I never knew that there were still union jobs available for radio personalities. I thought maybe if you're in Los Angeles or California, or Los Angeles, excuse me, or New York, the two largest markets when it comes to radio. But as a personality, I'm covered for that, with the on-air personalities. And it has a certain level of protections. And that was super appealing to me. And I like that sort of thing. It doesn't mean I'm all about unions all the time or anything, but I definitely see the benefits of it. There's good ones and there's bad ones. I mean, just like anything else, there's good and bad. But not everyone has protections when it comes to their job. Not everyone has security. And that's what leads to the worst jobs. And let me just go through this list real quick, which is basically going to lead up to my job. So photographer at 25, then it goes food server, roofer, welder, water transportation worker, which is interesting. Most water transportation workers make well above 54 grand. Piloting a boat of any size requires at least some expertise. Oh, okay, so that's what they mean by transport. So you're piloting a boat? Is that the right word? You're a boat pilot? Sounds like a band name you'd go see at a small club on the weekend. Brick Mason is at number 20. My buddy Jack, when he was growing up, wanted to be a brick mason. Why? Because his grandpa told him they make good money. So that's what he wanted to be. You know, how would you like to be an 8-year-old kid? What do you want to be when you grow up? Oh, a brick mason. That was him. Now, he didn't actually end up being a brick mason, but he's probably the hardest working person I've ever met in my life. The guy never sleeps, and he just loves to earn. So it doesn't matter what he's doing. He just wants to earn. Auto mechanic at number 19. A buyer at number 18. Commonly work on behalf of grocers and other wholesalers buying produce for resale at other stores. Truck driver at 17, construction worker, dock worker, bus driver, chef, firefighter. It's pretty stressful. Pest control worker. And then at number 10 is painter. Physically demanding job. You have to crouch, reach, kneel, do all these different things. I hate painting my house. When I moved here, of course, I prepared my house in Indiana for sale. We wanted to paint it. We wanted it to look nice. We wanted it to be at the best shape it could possibly be in. And I'll tell you what, it is not a job I'd want to do for a living. It is a lot of work. Okay, at number 9, advertising salesperson. Number 8, broadcaster. And number 7, disc jockey. So there's a difference apparently between a broadcaster and a disc jockey. And it's mostly pay. So if you want to feel a little higher class in what you do and you work in radio, call yourself a broadcaster. You might be able to bump yourself a little raise. And then corrections officer is at number 6. Enlisted military personnel at number 5. Retail sales at 4. Newspaper reporter at 3. Logger at 2. And taxi driver at 1. Lots of stress to be a taxi driver. You don't make a lot of money. And they say most taxi drivers earn less than $26,000 a year compared to the median American annual wage of $37,600. Wow. That's not a lot. And if you're out there driving for Uber, I feel for you, man. You know, there's ebbs and flows when it comes to these things, but those companies do not pay well. And I know a lot of people have these side hustles and things. You know, let's talk about that. So in the workplaces, what are the things that are stressful? What are the things that are appealing to millennials? Job security, things like that. Chris Tuff joining us next on KMOX. What a huge win for the Cardinals. What was the final score? Was it 12-5, something like that? 14-5? Do you remember? I can't remember. Oh, 13-8? No, that wasn't the score. Was it 13-8? Huh. Man, they put up 13 runs here at home. That's awesome. Welcome back to Overnight America. Real quick, let me get to Joy. Hey, Joy, what's going on?
Ryan?
Yes.
Okay, I could barely hear you. Oh, this is Joy, and I texted you a couple things about McCormick.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
When you're 9 years old, you don't want to hear about, you know, world news.
At 9, you didn't care for the nice voice? What were you doing up that late?
My dad had the radio on. I couldn't get to sleep.
So you would listen to John McCormick at 8 every night, and you hated it?
Oh, I didn't. Well, I actually now I don't. But at that time, it's like I got to go to school, Dad. You know, turn off the radio. But
what was he doing up that late? Was he just a night owl?
Yeah. Mm. Oh, he would. Well, we were in Gulfport, Mississippi, and he would have KMOX on every night.
Yeah.
And then when we moved back up here, he would have it on too. And it's like I don't understand your fascination with it, and now I do.
You get it.
This is a compliment to you.
I wish I could have met him. I think, did he pass in 91-ish, somewhere in there? It was early 90s. So his wife must have lived on for a while. And, you know, the estate sale going on just reminds you, get rid of your stuff before it's too late. Give it to people that want it.
That's what I'm going
to
start doing.
I know. It's a good thing to do. All right. Good to hear from you, Joy. Thank you. Have a great night.
Well, thank you. You too. Have a good one.
Yeah. I will be putting belly rubs for sure on the table there. And joining us now is the author of the new book, The Millennial Whisperer. It's author Chris Tuff. Thanks for coming on to KMOX.
Yeah, great to be here.
The Practical Profit-Focused Playbook for Working with and Motivating the World's Largest Generation. You know, these millennial stories are a dime a dozen. It seems like every other website wants to pop up the latest thing that you know, millennials are outraged about or things you should be upset about because millennials are doing or whatever. Kind of drives me a little crazy, too, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's driven me crazy for years. I mean, I've been working with them. I mean, I'm right on the cusp. You know, I'm 38. So, you know, according to statistics, they're 37-year-olds to 23-year-olds, which is ridiculous, right? I mean, it's such a massive group of people. And, you know, one of the things I set out to do initially in The Millennial Whisperer, my book, is I think it's really two very different generations within that, older millennials and younger millennials. And what makes them so different is two things. One, when in their lives they started kind of using mobile phones and social media. Mm-hmm. So the older millennials, they had beepers in college. You know, they didn't really get social media until after their college or later in their college careers. And then the younger millennials were given an iPhone with a Snapchat account on it. And then the other big variable is when the recession hit them, the older millennials, or their parents, the younger millennials. And it's really those two things that make them two very different. I call them Oregon Trail millennials and Snapchat millennials. Oregon Trail because they played Oregon Trail, and then Snapchat because they had Snapchat account.
That's the way to look at it. What was the age range again for a millennials today?
23 to 37.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I'm on the high end of it. I'm 35. So when I went to school, I went to college. My first year was 2001. I didn't have a cell phone. No one I knew had a cell phone. It was like unheard of to have a cell phone. Even in 2001, I might have known one or two people. And I remember growing up in Oregon Trail, you better believe, when we went to the computer lab in grade school, everyone grabbed that or Carmen Sandiego. It was the only two fun games, you know, that they had in the educational bin.
Totally. I was there with you. Where in the world is Carmen Sandiego? I love it.
And we always had those old Mac computers that were way outdated, but we didn't know any better. And
Apple IIc.
Yeah, and I remember they used to bring in people to talk to us about what is the internet. Bring your family. You'll learn what the internet is. You know, and then they would do these, like, group talks, and we kept thinking, oh, wow, who can afford to have the internet in their home? And what do they do with it even? And I remember I thought it was the coolest kid ever, the day we got internet at our house.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and I talk about my daughter, you know, you talk about technology and with kind of, you know, how it makes a generation very different. I talk about how my 7-year-old, when two, I walked up to our flat screen TV and I was like, honey, why are there fingerprints all along the bottom? And it was because she was trying to swipe the TV on,
like
an iPhone.
I totally understand that. You're right about it's weird if you're at one of the low-end or high-end millennials. Totally understand that because I feel like I don't really identify with the 23-year-olds, and I don't think I ever could identify with it. It seems like they grew up in a completely different world, so I got to imagine that also shapes the workplace when you see that range. And even though we're only separated by, you know, 10 or 15 years, that's a big gap.
Well, you know, and one of my favorite quotes that has come out of the book is one of my friends, Evan, turned to me after reading the book. He goes, you know, what I've discovered is millennials aren't the problem. They just expose all the problems. And, you know, I think that's essentially, I've tried to create a book where people can read it and they can start instituting big changes in the way that they manage this workforce. And, you know, a lot of it is just kind of common sense, which is, you know, that line between kind of friendships and work, as well as kind of where work and play, you know, cell phone kind of got in the middle of all of that. So, you know, I think one of the things is as Americans that we all can attest to is that there's a massive need for empathy and connection. And, you know, I use, you know, some of the stuff I bring up in the book is in your one-on-ones with your people, give them the option if they want to talk about work or if they want to talk about being just what's going on in their lives. And I use an executive, one of my friends, Mike Hibison from Home Depot. He gives everyone that option. 80% of the time, they decide to talk about life. Hmm. And it's through that, you know, the profit will follow. The work ethic will follow as soon as there's connection. You know, when people, especially this generation, when they don't feel that connection, they're just going to quit. You know, the other side of it is what we all do. You know, I say all the time that we got to stop comparing our insides to other people's outsides. And I also call it like the Pinterestation of this generation. There's no better example of it than the first day of school. All of our news feeds are people posting those perfect pictures of their kids. And, you know, these are millennial parents. And it's got that kind of chalkboard with Ashley's third grade and their teacher and everyone's smiling. It's exhausting.
Hmm.
And so, you know, one of my rules that I put in there is I call it my 70-30 rule, and I instill it into everyone on my team, all 30 millennials. And it's that 30% of life is hard. 30% of what we do isn't going to be right in line with our kind of passion and purpose. 70% of your job should fuel you up and fire you up. But you've got to understand that that grass is always greener complex is in all of us, you know, and we've got to stop kind of quitting our jobs trying to seek it out.
Wow, that's interesting. So the book is called The Millennial Whisperer, the Practical Profit-Focused Playbook for Working with and Motivating the World's Largest Generation, and author Chris Tuff joins us here on KMOX. One of the things that I notice, because I do a show on the weekends that focuses on family business, and we talk to a lot of different family business owners, and we talk to the next generation. We talk about the transitions that put them in the ownership roles and the leadership roles in their own business. And one of the things I realized was that a lot of times the next generation that comes in, they always have a lot of different ideas on how they want to handle it different than the way their parents handled it. They want to come in and they want to do it this way and do it that way. But the people we talk to and the ones that help facilitate that generational transition say to the next generation, you know, it's worked for your parents and their parents and their parents for all of these years. You have to at least try it their way before you try to completely flip the business upside down and try it your way, because you got to get your feet on the ground. You got to you got to be in their shoes. You got to understand why they're doing the things they're doing. And I see that sometimes with, you know, the generation and maybe the younger millennials that are coming in, they want to get in there and they want to always do it their way, but they don't really have the respect or the understanding of how it was done before. So they try to skip that step before they actually know how to do it. So is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, I think if you look at what millennials are looking for out of anything, you know, out of leaders, and this is what the book really focuses on, they're looking for inspirational leadership. They're looking for autonomy. They're looking for transparency. And they're looking for real purpose in what they're doing. And I think, you know, that transparency and autonomy thing is really important, where people misinterpret what that looks like. And I think your point is a really good one. And what they're really looking for in that transparency and autonomy is, you know, specifically in the transparency, is give me the facts. Give me as much of this stuff as I can. Don't hide some of the things from me so I can actually learn where it is that I need to be affecting change. And, you know, the other piece is that, you know, I think that, I mean, it took me 64 job interviews after graduating from Vanderbilt to actually find a job.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think, especially with family-owned businesses, it's these children aren't necessarily falling into a place where their passions lie. So, you know, one thing I really, you know, try to encourage is more lateral moves and more cross pollination, so people can, especially during those young ages, not be distracted with, you know, fortune and the big title, and instead look within themselves. Where do your passions and purpose lie? And then work backwards to find the right gig for that. For a family-owned business, it might not necessarily be running it. It might be, you know, doing something else. But you're absolutely right. You know, one thing I also encourage is everyone should have a side hustle on my team. And so what happens is people will, I have one example of a woman on my team, and she pursued her side hustle. I helped her create the cap table, raise a little bit of money, and it was a clothing company, and it completely failed. And she was like, Chris, this is a lot harder than I thought it would be. I'm glad I didn't quit my job to go pursue this. I'm like, exactly. And that's what happens. Every single person that's pursued some of these side hustles, they figure out quickly, man, this is really hard. And I think you bring up a great point there.
He is the Millennial Whisperer, and that's the name of the book, The Practical Profit-Focused Playbook for Working with and Motivating the World's Largest Generation. I'm on the tail end of a millennial, and it feels a little bit weird every time I'm talking about a 23-year-old millennial. I just don't know how to understand that. We feel like we're in two different worlds, and we kind of are. So we're going to continue our conversation next with Chris Tuff about millennials on Overnight America KMOX.
Now, more of Overnight America with Ryan Recker on KMOX.
Welcome back to Overnight America. I'm your host, Ryan Recker, joined with our guest, the author of The Millennial Whisperer, the practical profit-focused playbook for working with and motivating the world's largest generation, Chris Tough. Thank you again for coming on. It's funny, you talk about the things pursue what fills you up. And yeah, you know, there's that one of the recent things, and they do this all the time. They bring out the worst 10 jobs or the worst 50 jobs in America. And for me, it always hurts and stings when you see two of the top 10 happen to be in my field, either DJ or broadcaster or newspaper writer or TV anchor things. There's always like a couple of them in the top 10 worst jobs in the country. So I feel like everyone, they have to be passionate to get into an industry like this. It's not a safe industry. And there is a little bit of risk that goes into doing the things you really love. But you got to, I guess, figure out what you love. And there's always adaptations of the things you love that could fulfill you, too. You may think in your head that you're going to be the next superstar quarterback in the NFL. But when that doesn't happen, when you don't get drafted after college or whatever it is, there's other things you can do that are very fulfilling that are related to the passions that you love. And, you know, when it comes to coaching or it comes to health or it comes to anything, I mean, the sports industry is very large. So I feel like as long as you go into it open, knowing that you're finding something you like, you're going to find something you like.
Well, and I think, you know, people need to realize that in this world of instant everything, right? Instant gratification, mm-hmm. You know, it takes a lot of hard work, and it takes leaders to instill that in their people, that it doesn't matter what you're doing, whether it be fitness, whether it be health, whether it be running that marathon or finding that job, it takes a lot of hard work. And I think sometimes in our businesses, we emphasize on the big audacious goals versus all of those incremental pieces to help fuel that hard work that happens over time.
You know, how do I, as a millennial, and I look at this as, you know, I say me, but I feel like I really have a hard time identifying with it most times. When I look at some of the different trends of the younger millennials, and since I'm in news talk, I see the, you know, the culture of they're always offended and they're always this and they're, you know, they can't come on a college campus and speak. And, you know, you see all of these different trends that are contradictory to the things I believe, even though I'm lumped in with a millennial. And a lot of times I'll look back and I'll say, man, I sure do hate this generation. How do I not feel that way? Like, how do I feel optimistic and take those things that I see as disappointing, but actually look at it in a different light so I'm not always disappointed?
Well, I mean, I think if you look at the title, I mean, The Millennial Whisperer is the title of my book, but the front cover is all of those negatives that you bring up, right? Entitled is in big, bold, you know, needy, young, dumb, disrespectful. I think that's what I'm trying to change the conversation. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, I've done a lot of interviews at this point, and oftentimes people will call out someone, some millennial leader or some millennial politician that's done something, and it's my response is always, well, we've got to stop using millennial as a synonym for inexperienced and young.
Interesting. Author Chris Tough and his best-selling book, The Millennial Whisperer. One other question for you. When you talk about accommodation, I look at some things as almost fake accommodation, where they say we have to cater to millennials, so they do things that they think cater to the millennials. And sometimes I cringe when I see certain things. And I know there's some workplaces that are like really hip. You know, you're over on the West Coast. I've never been to like Google or Facebook's headquarters. But, you know, you see photos and everything's colorful and they got slides and they're doing yoga and getting massages over here and things like that. So then a place like here in St. Louis will say, oh, we got to cater to the millennials. So, you know, they try to sprinkle in things, but it never really resonates with the people that are working there. It's like a completely different culture. So is there fake accommodation, and can you overdo it trying to cater to things that you think are good?
100%. And, you know, I think in those cases, I use an example in the book of a woman that pulled me aside, and she was like, Chris, I mean, you have 370 employees, 90% millennials. They seem to be thriving. What's the secret? And I was like, okay, well, I'm writing a book on it, so I'm going to include you in it. I'm going to call you another name. But she said they had hired a barista and they had a cereal bar. And she was like, I've got a barista on, I'm paying her a salary. People can get whatever coffee they want. I have a cereal bar with over 30 cereals so people can get cereal anytime they want. Because I hear these millennials love cereal. And I said, there's a much larger problem here, and you're just trying to get a quick fix.
Yeah.
With this, with the barista. You know, it, a lot of times the issues lie within the leadership, and where they're not actually, you know, doing those things that I think this generation craves the most, which is, inspirational leadership. A lot of leaders think they're inspirational, and they're not necessarily inspirational.
Oh,
which is also why I created a survey, a 360 survey that you can download on my website, themillennialwhisperer.com, and you can actually see whether or not from your people you're inspirational. But I think we're oftentimes, I say on the back, bring the beer kegs home, forget about the ping pong table, put the participation trophies in the trash where they belong.
Yeah.
Because I think we're just trying to get a quick fix to accommodate for this generation, and we're not getting to the heart of the problem. And the book is all about those things.
Totally agree. So The Millennial Whisperer, it's out now. If people want to check out the book, where to find it, and where can they find you?
I'm at Chris Tuff on Twitter, and at themillennialwhisperer.com. You can download the first chapter, see if you actually like it. And then, by the way, millennial is two L's and two N's. I learned that the hard way because I wrote the book and said it so many times. So themillennialwhisperer.com. And then Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any of your local bookstores should have them. And, you know, it's getting excited. We've sold just over 30,000 copies, and I think we're just getting warmed up.
Awesome. Author Chris Tuff, and again, the book, The Millennial Whisperer, the practical profit-focused playbook for working with and motivating the world's largest generation. Thank you so much for coming on to KMOX.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, anytime. He was good. I thought he was really good. I told him it's hard not to be disappointed sometimes. How can I not be as disappointed with my own kind? You know, millennials. It's almost fun. It's become a joke at some point where you make fun of millennials for something. I think when it comes to the job market, you get a lot of companies saying, oh, millennials are killing this, or oh, millennials are killing that. What do you want? You want to force them to buy the same things that their parents bought? You know what? You have to market to them in a certain way, or you have to find things that appeal to them. And you know what? It's their money and they're going to buy the things they want. Don't be disappointed when they don't buy your product or eat your food or whatever it is, right? That's kind of how supply and demand works, right? The people are able to make their own decisions with how they spend their money. They're not ruining any industry. You know, they just have their own preferences. Well, that does it for me. You can follow me on Twitter at Ryan Recker. Very easy way to follow along with the show is by going to the website, kmox.com/ONA. If it's one of your favorite shows and you enjoy listening every night, a great way you can support the show is by going to kmox.com/ONA and click that subscribe button or leave us a nice 5-star review. The more reviews we get, the better it helps our podcast get discovered by new people. So please go do that. Enjoy the rest of your night. We'll be back again tomorrow.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto-pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto-pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.